Midwest Jazz Collective presents the Benny Banach III Quartet for two shows at 7 and 9 p.m. on Monday, April 7th at Cafe Coda. Emmy-nominated trumpeter and singer Benny Banach III has proven to be that rarest of talents. Not only a fiery trumpet player with a stirring command of the post-bop trumpet vernacular, but also a singer with a sly, mature, naturally expressive delivery in the post-Sinatra mold. Third in a generational line of Pittsburgh jazz notables, Benny follows in the footsteps of his trumpeter and bandleader grandfather, Benny Banach Sr., and his father, Benny Banach Jr., who gave the young Benny his first professional experience. Benny's group includes Tyler Henderson on piano, Caleb Tabachman on bass, and Joe Perry on drums. More information at cafecoda.club. Midwest Jazz Collective presents the Benny Banach III Quartet for two shows at 7 and 9 p.m. on Monday, April 7th at Cafe Coda. You are listening to WORT Madison.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. The Sudanese army says it's retaken control of the airport in Khartoum, which had been held by the rival paramilitary Rapid Support Forces for almost 2 years. With RSF fighters withdrawing fast, the army says it's close to establishing full control across the whole of the capital. Barbara Platusha sent this report from Port Sudan.
The Khartoum airport is in the central part of the city. A commander on the ground told the BBC that troops had fully secured it and might be able to clear the rest of the capital of RSF fighters by the end of the day. The army's been moving swiftly since recapturing the presidential palace on Friday, and some civilians have been celebrating in the streets as it advances. Earlier, a military spokesman said troops had taken control of Manshia Bridge, the last bridge that was still in the hands of the RSF, as well as a military camp in its remaining stronghold in the southern part of the city.
In the past few minutes, The Atlantic magazine has published the full text of a group chat in which senior members of the Trump administration planned airstrikes on Yemen. The magazine editor was accidentally copied in. It contains precise details of the times US warplanes would take off and missiles launched. President Trump has denied that the messages contained classified information. At least 24 people have been killed in the deadliest forest fires in South Korea's history. Tens of thousands of people have been evacuated from their homes. The fires, which began several days ago, are spreading rapidly because of strong winds and dry conditions, Shaima Khalil reports.
A 79-year-old evacuee described how the fire came down the mountains and engulfed his house. The fires gutted the 1,300-year-old Kunsa Temple in the same area, where many cultural relics were removed and transported to safer ground. In the nearby city of Andong, people described how they had to leave their homes quickly to shelter in a school, as the flames spread widely, fanned by the strong winds. Wildfires are relatively uncommon in South Korea, and related fatalities are rare. The current fires are already the deadliest on record.
Denmark has welcomed changes to a controversial trip by the US Vice President J.D. Vance and his wife to Greenland. Mr. Vance will now only visit a US military base and has cancelled plans to attend social events. Adrian Murray has this report from Copenhagen.
Speaking to Danish radio, Foreign Minister Lars Løkke Rasmussen described the alterations to the US delegation's schedule as positive. He said that Mr. Vance's visit might look like increasing pressure on Denmark, but that by confining it to the US base, Washington was actually de-escalating. President Trump has repeatedly said he wants to take control of Greenland, and the uninvited visit by senior US officials has drawn widespread condemnation in both Greenland and Denmark. Now plans for Mr. Vance's wife, Usha, to visit the capital Nuuk and attend a dog sled race will no longer take place.
Adrian Murray with that report from Copenhagen. This is World News from the BBC.
The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. This year's festival boasts over 170 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got comedies, dramas, experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. This year we'll be showing films at the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater, as well as four venues on the UW-Madison campus. And we'll be spending the last 4 days of the festival at Flick's Brewhouse at the East Town Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2025 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 3rd through Thursday, April 10th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
WORT is excited to be in our 50th year, and to help celebrate, we are hosting the opening night of Madison's newest venue, the Atwood Music Hall. Join us on Friday, June 13th for a great night honoring Clyde Stubblefield. The night features performances from Mama Dig Down's Brass Band, The Funky JBs, VO5, Rare Element, DJ Trevor Banks, and Kaboom Box. Andy Moore from the Friday 8 o'clock Buzz will host the evening celebrating 50 years of WORT and the grand opening of Madison's newest venue at 1925 Winnebago Street. Proceeds from the evening benefit WORT. Tickets are $25 in advance and available now at theatwoodmusichall.com. Be sure to shine up your dancing shoes and grab your tickets before they're gone.
For over 10 years, Mama Cares has been there for local musicians in their time of need, whether to help with medical expenses or other personal calamities. Madison Area Music Association invites you to Mama Cares' 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon, featuring live performances by Sam Ness, Gin Chocolate and Bottle Rockets, and The Jimmies. Help your local musicians and enjoy some live music at the Mama Cares 10th Anniversary Ball, Sunday, March 30th, from 3 to 8 p.m. at the High Noon Saloon. You're listening to WORT Madison.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, March 26th, and this is the 8 o'clock Buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Linda Benesch, the Communications Director at Social Security Works. Social Security Works fights to protect and expand Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, lower drug prices, ensure economic justice for all, and guarantee health care as a human right. And they say that Musk and Trump are seeking to discredit Social Security by spreading, you know, long debunked lies about fraud in the system. And yet they've eliminated the Social Security Inspector General. They've terminated the leases on 1,200 field offices, and that the administration is taking steps to hollow out the Social Security administration. And that Frank Bisignano, the person nominated to lead the agency, is part of the manufactured chaos, they say, at the Social Security Administration. So stay tuned to hear from Linda Benesch. Also, I'll be speaking with David Armiak, Research Director and Investigative Reporter at the Center for Media and Democracy, and I'll be speaking with him about his piece, Wisconsin's Right-Wing Infrastructure Works in Lockstep to Elect Schimmel to the State Supreme Court. So there's been media attention focused on the millions of dollars Elon Musk has poured into Wisconsin, but Armiak says that an in-state network of right-wing political donors, groups, and operatives have teamed up to spend even more for Schimmel than Musk has. And then later I'll be speaking with Sarah Lynn. Sarah Lynn is Director of Development at DaneNet. And DaneNet's mission is to make information technology accessible and affordable through education and services for nonprofits and individuals with barriers. So next month, they're hosting an Earth Day e-cycling event. So an electronic recycling day to raise money for digital equity while safely disposing of old technology. So stay tuned to hear from Sarah Lynn. Stay tuned to the program. We'll be right back.
On the beat of the doom, bitty, like we used to do when we play the jazz, kill it. I say, doom, bitty. innocent spree. You reach for the top of the coconut tree. The girl in the corner with the dreadlocks wants to come along. Come on, take her along. Hey, Mr. Drinking, where are you going? With a pocket full of stars hanging on your shoulder. Say, hey, Mr. Drinking, where are you flying? Flying, flying high. En la playa donde jugábamos cuando era niños. Para celebrar la vida en la playa de Cádiz. Celebrar la vida en la playa de Bahía. Festival Calabá con amigos de la calle.
It is 8:10 and joining me is Linda Benesch, Communications Director at Social Security Works. Social Security Works fights to protect and expand Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, lower drug prices, ensure economic justice for all, and guarantee health care as a human right. And they say the future of Social Security is on the line. That Musk and Trump are seeking to discredit Social Security by spreading long debunked lies. They have terminated leases on 1,200 field offices. They are taking steps to hollow out the agency. And that Frank Bisignano, the person nominated to lead Social Security, is part of the manufactured chaos there. So I'm just glad to have Linda Benesch back on WORT this morning. Hey, Linda, good morning.
For having me back on the show.
Hey, great, Linda. Hey, Linda, so where do we start? Maybe we'll start with the news yesterday. Your reaction to what you saw at the confirmation hearings?
Yeah, so yesterday was the confirmation hearing for Frank Bisignano, who is President Trump's choice to lead Social Security. And Bisignano, you know, if he's confirmed, he would be coming into an agency that, as you were saying, it's very much in turmoil because the Trump administration has installed an acting commissioner who's basically just a figurehead for Elon Musk's Doge. And is like already, even though the agency doesn't even have a Senate confirmed commissioner yet, they're making these enormous, really detrimental to beneficiaries changes, including they're cutting phone services, they're planning to close field offices, they're pushing out thousands of staff. And so what we were watching for yesterday was like any sign that Bisignano, you know, would be any change from what's happening. But our takeaway is that, in fact, he's someone who would keep these awful changes going and, in fact, like even make this worse. And that's kind of, it's something that we suspected already from his background. He's a Wall Street CEO and a multi-billionaire. One year he was the second highest paid CEO on Wall Street. And at his past private companies that he's worked for, he has a history of laying off staff, slashing their benefits, creating toxic work environments. So that's what we're very concerned that he could do at the Social Security Administration. And at the hearing, the Democratic senators, they were really pressing him on, you know, if he had any relationship with Doge. And he actually did something that even we didn't expect that he would do, which is he tried to deny that he had a connection with Doge, even though lots of sources from inside SSA have been saying that he did. And Senator Ron Wyden actually had a whistleblower letter in hand that said that he's been talking to a lot of the people that Doge has sent to the agency for months. And so Bisignano is not someone who's just been waiting outside until he got confirmed. He's actually been involved with a lot of these cuts to services and staff that have happened. He's directing it from the outside, and he just tried to completely deny it at the hearing, and Ron Wyden called him out. He said, you know, that would be very reassuring that you don't have ties with Doge, but unfortunately, it's not true. And here's this evidence that I have in my hand, this letter from a high-ranking Social Security Administration official that says that you've been working very closely with them all along.
Now, it seems just because they sort of control the table that this will go through, right?
Most likely. I mean, you know, we're doing our best to pressure all senators and urge people to call all senators and say that they should vote no. And we're hoping at least to keep Democrats unified, send the message, you know, there's absolutely no bipartisanship here. This is just Donald Trump's partisan pick. And, you know, also the fact that he was willing to lie under oath in a Senate confirmation hearing, like in more normal times, that would be disqualifying. But, yeah, realistically, unfortunately, compared to some of Trump's other nominees, he doesn't have, like, the kind of personal scandals, you know, or just over-the-top unqualifiedness that people who still got confirmed, like Pete Hegseth and Tulsi Gabbard, RFK Jr., you know, had. And so, unfortunately, if those folks are able to get confirmed, we do at this point anticipate that the Republicans are going to push him through.
And you know, that you said starting off there that this is not a partisan issue. This is a very popular program. People across the American public supports Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare. Can you talk about how important this is to people? Let's, you know, talk about that, because we're hearing so much that discredits Social Security. This is really important.
Yes, absolutely. So Social Security, it's our most popular and effective government program, and almost 70 million Americans rely on either Social Security or other companion programs administered by the Social Security Administration. This is, you know, how tens of millions of people are putting food on the table, paying for their medication, paying their rent. And so, you know, it's just so important to families across America. And that's why, you know, it was just so just striking and horrifying when Donald Trump's Commerce Secretary, Howard Butnick, recently in an interview, he said that if Social Security were to miss a check, which what a thing, you know, to suggest, first of all, then his mother-in-law, who happens to be the mother-in-law of a billionaire, because Butnick is yet another billionaire in Trump's cabinet, would not complain if her Social Security check didn't come on time. And then he said, and if you do complain, then you're probably a fraudster, because they're the ones who complain. Now, how out of touch do you have to be with, like, any working person in America, any retiree, any person with disabilities, anyone who relies on Social Security, to think that if a check doesn't come on time that people wouldn't notice or complain? But that's who we're being led by right now.
So what is the best way to ensure Social Security sustainability?
So Social Security, in about 10 years, it faces a relatively modest funding shortfall, and benefits wouldn't stop, but they would be cut by about 20%, which is completely unacceptable if Congress were to do nothing. Now, what Congress should do, and something that my organization, Social Security Works, has been fighting for a long time and working with members of Congress on legislation to do, is to lift the cap on Social Security contributions, so that, like, currently people after about their first $170,000 in income stop paying into Social Security, which means that most of us are paying in all year long, but the highest earners in the country stop paying in partway through the year, and Elon Musk was done paying in on January 1st. And so if we lift that cap and make the wealthy pay in on all of their income as well as their unearned investment income, then we can protect and expand Social Security for generations to come.
And so there is a solution out there other than privatizing. And I'm saying something that I know our listeners understand, but, you know, I want to put that narrative, that statement, that truth out there.
Yeah, that's extremely true. And it's also, that solution, it's very popular with Republican, Democratic, and independent voters alike. We see numbers upwards of 80% support and polling even with Republicans. And, you know, I think Republican politicians, they see that too. And that's why they don't talk very much about what their preferred solutions would be, which are things like raising the retirement age, cutting benefits for the middle class, and yes, privatization. But for many years, they've been pretty shy about putting legislative proposals on the table. And instead, they say, no, we should create a commission and go behind closed doors with Democrats and then come out with benefit cuts, and we won't know which party is to blame. Voters won't know. And so that's kind of something that we were anticipating might happen with DOGE and the Trump administration, and it still could. But what's been happening instead is this backdoor attack where they're not at this point focused on legislation at all. They're focused on breaking Social Security, making it so hard for people to get their own benefits by slashing staff at the agency that administers it, closing field offices so that people have to travel hundreds of miles, and creating these really long wait times on the phone because there's so little staff that people are going to have a much harder time getting their own benefits, and that some people, including Martin O'Malley, who was the leader of Social Security under Joe Biden, are even predicting that Social Security is losing so much expertise that it is possible that there could start to be disruptions to payments at some point in the near future. So we don't know if that's something that's going to happen, but unfortunately, for the first time in Social Security's nearly 90-year history in which it's never missed a payment, that's become a real possibility. And that seems to be the Republican endgame here, is just break Social Security so then they can swoop in and say we have to save it by privatizing it.
For those who are younger, folks who are really healthy and strong and thank goodness. But what does privatization mean, though? So folks, maybe there's a better word for that, right? But privatization, does that mean that, our retirement would be, I think of it being at the whims of the stock market.
Yeah, that's right. So one form of privatization is that instead of Social Security being a guaranteed or benefit that people pay into and then they get benefits back, as long as they're alive during retirement. So you can live to be, 80 or 90 or 100, and Social Security, just keeps coming. It's the one retirement income that you can't run out of, and instead turning it into something more like a 401k where it's at the whims of the stock market, where there's a finite amount and you can run out. And that's what George W. Bush starts to do, and it may also be an end game here. But then there's another form of privatization that we're worried about as well, which is that they're trying to turn the Social Security Administration's operations potentially over to Wall Street. And so right now, Social Security, it's incredibly efficiently run. 99% of every dollar that people pay in goes out in benefits. Less than a penny is spent on administration. And it seems like they're now trying to break that administration so that they can bring in Wall Street firms to do it instead and take a much larger cut off the top.
Right. I mean, that would, solely be then, at least a top priority would be for profit for the shareholders.
Exactly.
The idea that is a viable long-term solution to lift the cap above $170,000. Is that going, where's that at? And in that kind of this field of questions, what are people doing? What are you guys doing to organize? I know there's a big day of mobilization coming up.
Yeah, so I think I'll take that second question first. So, we have a website, Hands Off Social Security, with updates on actions happening around the country. And so some of those are timed with the larger day of action that people may have heard about on April 5th, where there's going to be mobilizations happening all over the country to say Hands Off Social Security, as well as Medicaid, Affordable Care Act, or health care, and all the other things that are under attack from the Trump administration. And then we're also having rallies before and after that day, too. So the website is continually updated, and there have been a lot already at Social Security offices around the country. And our goal there has been, to really just draw attention to get coverage on the local news, which there has been quite a bit of. And the national press, too, is as interested in Social Security as I've ever seen them in 10 years of working on this program. So, there is coverage of what the Republicans are doing to Social Security in places like the Associated Press and Reuters and even the Washington Post. Jeff Bezos is allowing it, and they actually have had some really good exposés for the time being. And so like, that's one thing that I think people are hearing about it, even if they don't read the papers, it's on TV, and getting really angry and concerned. We see it showing up in polling now that people are much more worried about Social Security than they were a month ago. And we have seen in some instances, like when there's reporting on some of the worst things that they're trying to do, like at one point, the current acting Social Security commissioner, who's about the pettiest man imaginable, he canceled Maine's contract that allows people to sign up their newborn babies for Social Security cards at the hospital, and made it so that you had to go into a Social Security office and wait for hours with your newborn baby to get them a Social Security card. And he admitted that he was doing it because he was mad at Maine's governor, Janet Mills, for defying Donald Trump. But that policy, after about a week, it broke in the media, and there were stories, there was outrage, and they did have to pull back on it. And I tell that story just to say that, you know, people's voices and their anger does matter, and that this administration is not, you know, completely immune from pressure. And so that's something that we're really trying to build up around the country. And we would love for folks to get involved in handsoffsocialsecurity.org. And very soon, probably today, we're going to be adding some more material there. So a toolkit on how to hold rallies and some signs that people can print out as well.
Is there any, wait, what was the website again?
Handsoffsocialsecurity.org.
And is there any support on any part of the aisle or either side of the aisle to support lifting the cap?
So in the last Congress, in the House, Congressman John Larson, he's the chair, or currently he's the ranking member of the Social Security Subcommittee, and he's a real champion on Social Security, has been out front on what's happening lately as well, has a bill called the Social Security 2100 Act that would lift that cap so that the wealthy pay their fair share. And in the last Congress, that had about 90% of Democrats. He hasn't reintroduced it yet this Congress because he's been so focused on what's happening at the Social Security Administration. But I think that that's something that's going to be happening soon. And at least, you know, on the Democratic side of the aisle, it is something that has broad support from moderates to progressives. And then on the Senate side, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and a few of their colleagues support another bill called the Social Security Expansion Act. But that one, even among Democrats, it really could use some more co-sponsors. So if folks have Democratic senators, I would encourage them to call and ask them to support the Social Security Expansion Act.
So this is what I think is going on. We're hearing from the administration that they're not going to cut Social Security, but they are hollowing it out. It will, if it's hollowed out, it would collapse and then be, you know, possibly ended up in some kind of privatized structure that could really change fundamentally what Social Security is there for. That Social Security is very popular amongst the people across parties. This isn't a partisan issue, and there is a sustainable solution. So I just wanted to have a positive discussion about Social Security this morning, but that there are real threats. It's not just to warn seniors or disabled, but it's on all of us. So I would just say that is my opinion. So, hey, thank you, Linda. Before we say so long, what are you looking at today? Will there be a vote for Bessignano?
I don't think it'll be for probably at least a week or so. You know, I'll keep you updated on that. But with the previous nominees, they don't necessarily rush to a floor vote right after the hearing. So I don't anticipate that that'll be this week.
Okay. Hey, thank you, Linda Benesch. I'm the communications director at Social Security Works. And you can check out their website as well. They work to protect and expand Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, lower drug prices, ensure economic justice for all, and guarantee health care is a human right. For all, regardless of party, right? Hey, thank you, Linda. It was great to talk with you.
Of course. Thank you so much, as always, for having me on.
Take care. It's just about 8:30, and we'll hear some music, and then David Ermiak, the research director and an investigative reporter at Center for Media and Democracy, will be joining me.
on the land of the man that used to walk very tall. They built a dark castle, built on the graves of the heroes of our childhood. We painted dreams of glory, graffitis, a million colors for everyone to know. We lost our hero. Jalele, jalele, jalele. Jalele na miye. Gofi Congo, les dictateurs nous ont arraché la vie. Docteur Atidepe, les dictateurs nous ont arraché la vie. Davio Amore, les dictateurs nous ont arraché la vie. Les peuples d'Afrique, les dictateurs vous ont compliqué la vie. J'ai toujours su qu'un jour je chanterai ton nom au reste du monde. You are my hero. Ils sauront tous que pour tes enfants tu t'es vraiment battu. Les graffitis multicolores de ta renaissance récitent l'histoire de ta vie. L'histoire de ta vie. Oh, jalele, jalele, jalele. Jalele na mie. Diallo Deli, les dictateurs nous ont arraché la vie. Amadou Diallo, les dictateurs nous ont arraché la vie.
It is 8:32, and here with me in the studio is David Armiak, Research Director and Investigative Reporter at the Center for Media and Democracy, and I am on the board of the Center for Media and Democracy. And I wanted to talk with him about his piece titled Wisconsin's Right-Wing Infrastructure Works in Lockstep to Elect Schimmel to State Supreme Court. That was the title. There has been a bit of media attention focused on the millions of dollars Elon Musk has poured into Wisconsin, but an in-state network of right-wing political donors, groups, and operatives have teamed up to spend even more for Schimmel. I'm not sure since that article came out if it's more than Musk at this point, because the latest is that there's even more Musk money in this race. So good morning, David Armiak. Thank you for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Hey, David. So maybe we'll start with just the Musk update. More money from Elon Musk focused on the Wisconsin Supreme Court race?
Yeah, it looks like another $2 million he put into the Wisconsin Republican Party's PAC recently. So, you know, according to our numbers, that's, you know, Musk is now pushing $20 million on this race. You know, so that's nearly $17.5 million through his America PAC and Building America's Future PAC. And then, you know, again, that, you know, $2 million to the Wisconsin GOP just last week. So really a staggering figure from one person, not from the state of Wisconsin, who doesn't have a whole lot of interest beyond, you know, what, you know, I would consider a pretty minor court case. Fighting over, you know, that might come to the Supreme Court, whether, you know, he can have his own dealerships here in the state rather than, you know, dealerships run by other individuals.
For his Teslas.
Yeah. Which they, you know, we should say, you know, you live here in Madison. There's a dealer. Or it looks like a dealer. I don't know. Some people are saying it's a showroom. I don't know. But there's something that's right on, you know, off the Beltline there. And there's another one in Milwaukee. So he is finding a way to get customers in the state without, you know, owning dealerships himself.
So he has business that is likely at will be in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So that's one interest, and then but it seems to exceed that. What do the PACs that he is channeling his money through interested? What are their priorities?
The PACs?
Yeah, because he's putting his money into
the PAC. I mean, that's a good question. Really, I feel that, you know, from what we've seen in the media, you know, is that Musk, you know, set up these PACs to support Donald Trump and Donald Trump's agenda, and, you know, really to make sure that folks in the Republican Party are falling in line. So, you know, if somebody does not vote to confirm one of his nominees or, you know, votes against one of his policies, he has said he will use the PACs to support primary challengers.
So again, what were the names of the PACs? And these are the PACs he had set up.
Yeah, and you may have seen ads for the, yes, from these or postcards or whatnot. America PAC and a Building America's Future PAC. And of course, you know, recently in the news, you know, it was reported that Musk had been encouraging people to sign a petition against so-called activist judges. And if you signed it, you would get $100. And if you referred to somebody else and they signed it, then that person would get $100 and you would get $100 as well. I've seen texts that people are receiving from other groups to encouraging them to sign this petition. So there, you know, seems to be, I don't know, some sort of coordination. But, you know, this is just things that I've seen from other people and we haven't had a chance to investigate.
So Elon Musk outpouring more into his PACs that are designed to support his and the president's agenda in Wisconsin.
Correct.
And that money is being then channeled into supporting the Schimmel to the state Supreme Court.
Yes, correct.
Now, the coordination in-state, because that's also, you know, important and was something you were really keeping an eye on sort of this right-wing infrastructure that has a privatization of schools, all kind of that sort of agenda. Can you talk about what's going on there?
Yeah, a lot of the impetus for this piece that I worked on with an extern that we have on staff this semester from Northwestern, Tom O'Connor, comes from, you know, our investigations almost 10 years ago now into the Bradley Foundation and internal records that we had examined that had been leaked on the dark web. And in that investigation, we found that the Bradley Foundation was systematically weaponizing philanthropy to support right-wing infrastructures in the state. And they had, you know, done so very well here in Wisconsin, and then they were looking to reevaluate state infrastructures in other states in order to invest and build up in those states and make substantial improvements in their eyes. So, you know, I was curious if we were to look at Wisconsin and just pull out the donors from the filings of Schimmel and the Wisconsin Republican Party, what would we see, right? And we saw, you know, kind of what we had expected, you know, the mega donors, you know, Richard Uihlein and his wife, Liz Uihlein. You know, these are folks that contributed $144 million to Republicans in the last election cycle. You know, had spent, you know, at the time of our report, $3.8 million, but has been updated and now is approaching $7 million through different PACs. You know, and so they've accounted for a lot of this money in state. But there are others, folks like Diane Hendricks, another Wisconsin GOP mega donor. Some of your listeners may know about ABC Roofing Supplies. Her husband had started that, or her late husband, I should say. And she is, you know, one of the wealthiest women in America. And she, you know, has contributed, you know, and with her family and employees, over $2 million to assist in getting Schimmel elected. And then there's groups that are associated with the Bradley, or I should say grantees of the Bradley Foundation, or those that work in lockstep with the Bradley Foundation on issues in Wisconsin, such as the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce, which is our version of the Chamber of Commerce or our state affiliate of that. Right. You know, board members in the Bradley Impact Fund, which is the Bradley Foundation's, you know, donor advised fund, the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty, which is the Bradley's MVP in the Wisconsin right wing network, their kind of litigation arm that brings suits on behalf of the groups that are allies of the right wing, or defends right wing priorities. I'll take a break there if you.
Well, you know, I'm just thinking, you know, right at the center, there are people who might be Republicans who could very well be Democrats. There's Democrats who could very well be Republicans. So wanted to ask you, when you're looking at this, what is a right wing? How are you defining that that agenda? Because that may really differ from most of us.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so oftentimes when we're thinking about this, we're thinking about, you know, sort of pro-corporate agenda, school privatization agenda. So many of these folks, you know, although they will deny it, they're anti-public schools, and that they're, you know, seeking to defund public schools and move money into, you know, vouchers or other privatization schemes. You know, they... Yeah, I mean, so things like this, they're, you know, oftentimes anti-union, and we point this out in our piece, right, that there's a challenge coming to Act 10 that would likely come to the next Supreme Court. So whether Schimmel or Crawford is on it, they will hear this challenge, right? And this took away collective bargaining rights for public employees.
And that's, you know, fair wages.
Correct.
Good work conditions, you know, safety and respect.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's
amazing,
what,
right? Like, and you see, and when I say like they're working in lockstep, right? Like Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty has been holding listening sessions on Act 10 and its so-called benefits in the state, right? Scott Walker has been talking about this, our former governor. He's the one that led this push to take away these rights from workers in the state. You know, they claim that a lot of money has been saved. Well, it's not all about money, right? These are, when you are able to collectively bargain, the workers themselves get more pay. They get better health care benefits. They get better retirement benefits, right? There's a collective power against these large companies. And then the large tax or the large billionaires and millionaires in the state, like the Ulines or Hendricks, you know, they don't want to be paying more in taxes, right? So this could result in them paying more in taxes. So they, you know, are against this. And, you know, we note this in our piece.
I'm going to, and good public schools, whether you live in a city or in a rural area.
Yes.
Right? Where you can have, like, Division V sports, which I was just enjoying over the weekend watching the basketball.
Right.
But I'm thinking, what would happen to this?
Yeah.
Right? You know?
Yeah, and there's a teacher shortage now in Wisconsin. I don't think that's an accident. I think that is in result of Act 10. You know, Wisconsin used to be a desirable place for teachers around the country to come and teach. We had some of the best schools in the country. I believe we still do have really great schools. Our teachers are great in this state. But we're unable to attract some of the best and brightest teachers because, you know, of Act 10 and the stripping away of collective bargaining rights.
Now, tell us more about that update, because there was a lot of money coming in from, you know, Wisconsin. I guess you would call them, you know, powerful folks.
Yeah, this race, like, it looks like, you know, could attract over $100 million, which is really staggering for one state Supreme Court race. You know, so yeah, we have also been tracking Charles Koch's AstroTurf operation, Americans for Prosperity, you know, which has been active really early on behalf of Brad Schimmel. And has spent over $3 million to this point. And they're also holding events for Brad Schimmel. They're you know, getting out folks, you know, probably paying canvassers to go door to door to get people to vote for Schimmel. We have money coming from, you know, the Wisconsin GOP, of course, close to $3 million at this point. The Republican State Leadership Committee, which runs something called the Judicial Fairness Fairness Initiatives, has committed over $2 million so far. And the RSLC gets over $1 million from fossil fuel interests. We expect there's going to be a lot of fossil fuel challenges to regulations following, you know, the Supreme Court decision and that overturned Chevron deference, which, you know, gave more power to regulatory agencies to set rules and whatnot. So now we're going to probably see a lot of challenges. So these are a lot of groups, you know, from outside the state. You know, Charles Cook is not from Wisconsin, right? So we have, you know, both this in-state infrastructure that's, you know, working in lockstep, you know, for their interests in state, but we also have some very wealthy individuals from outside the state. And in combination, they're spending tens of millions of dollars, which is really shocking. You know, and I should say, you know, Crawford on the other side is also attracting a large amount of money and money from out of state. You know, Pritzker, the governor from Illinois, is committed, you know, $500,000, $1 million from George Soros. And I think at this point, my team was telling me that the total spending supporting Crawford is now over $32 million.
And that's just, what could we do with all this money, right?
Yeah, right. But there's a lot of small donors,
yes, that's
right?
That's how I read some of that.
Yeah, so like, and I should preface by saying I didn't do this research myself, but, you know, the reports, you know, what we've seen, you know, very reputable organizations have said that most of the money that she's been raising is coming from small donors. And she's getting a lot of outside help as well. It's really just pretty crazy to watch all this unfold. It's so much money. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, anybody watches TV is seeing all the ads. There are ads, you know, on YouTube. There's ads on TikTok. Yeah. They're really all over the place for this race.
So, you know, when I talk to folks or to loved ones, it's like, well, they're all doing that. And I guess I would say that this money, at least from these big donors such as Musk, is to support and to punish those who do not support the Trump agenda. So I think it does matter what the money is trying to achieve. And it's not enough that everybody does it.
Right. And I've seen communications from some of these Republican political groups talking about how, you know, it matters for redistricting. You know, and, you know, or drawing the maps or what other people, you know, call gerrymandering. Of course, Wisconsin, you know, had very gerrymandered maps for many years. And just recently, the courts, you know, changed that when the majority shifted to a liberal majority, right, from a conservative majority, which it had been for many years. So if Schimmel were to win, he is the conservative candidate, that, you know, would change the composition of the court, and therefore there could be more challenges, and we might end up, you know, with less fair maps here in Wisconsin again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge thing, and that would benefit Trump. You know, and in particular, the House majority, like if we're talking about Congress, if they were to redraw congressional districts, that House majority is very slim. So if it were to be more representative of the kind of, you know, Wisconsin division, which is almost 50-50, as anybody who votes regularly knows and follows, you know, the Democrats would get more people in office, which could shift the majority in the House to a Democratic majority. So these have consequences, you know, for Washington and Trump and Musk as well, you know, who supports this agenda.
And what that agenda is important. So, hey, David Armiak, Research Director and Investigative Journalist at the Center for Media and Democracy. We'll know this time next week the outcome of the election, you know, probably. So, you know, we'll just see. Hey, we'll be talking more this year about all of that that's going on, especially leading up to the midterms, about a constitutional convention, about an amendment to allow Trump to have a third term, all kinds of things to talk about. So thank you, David Armiak, for being with me this morning. It's 8:49. We're going to take a quick music break, and then joining me will be Sarah Lynn from DayNet. So stay with us.
Upside down hill in the ghetto, optical illusion, we can climb it all so easy. Everyday people who drop on the knees in a prayer, they've been kept away for so long at a distance from the place.
Hey, it's just about 8:50, and joining me is Sarah Lynn, Director of Development at DayNet. So DayNet's mission is to make information technology accessible and affordable through education and services for nonprofits and for individuals with barriers. So next month, they're hosting an Earth Day e-cycling event and electronic recycling day to raise money for promoting digital equity while safely disposing of old technology. So I want to, hey, Sarah Lynn, thank you for joining me.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hey, Sarah, so, you know, I actually, in preparing for this, did learn more about DaneNet and thought, you know, I needed to talk more about what you do. So for folks who aren't familiar with DaneNet, can you talk about DaneNet's mission?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that introduction. We are working towards digital equity in two main ways. The first one is by providing tech support to our fellow nonprofits at an affordable rate. And so we're that tech guy that's back in the server room or helping to fix the Wi-Fi or the, you know, laptop problem that you're having at the front desk. We have over 100 nonprofit clients in the local area that we provide tech support to. The other side of our programming is called the Digital Equity Project, and this is where we're working to bridge the digital divide for the individuals that are in our community. And that happens a couple of different ways. The two main ways are that we are collecting used laptops, refurbishing them, getting them all fixed up, and then handing them out through our nonprofit partners to folks that don't otherwise have a device to access the internet. Just households and individuals in the community. We also provide a lot of free digital skills classes at local libraries, community centers, senior centers, trying to help people build that knowledge base, gain the confidence to be able to use their devices and the internet to their greatest extent, you know, to access all the resources that are available online.
You know, the barriers can be equipment for sure. Mm-hmm. But there are folks who still can't even access internet service. Is that something you can help people with, or who can help with that? Or is that just something not that readily available and while there's a need?
Right. So that is kind of the third branch of digital equity, is accessing internet services. If you go to our website, there's a link to the Public Service Commission's Affordable Internet Finder, and you can type in your address, and it shows you the affordable internet options that are available to you at that address. So mostly what DaneNet does is provide the access to that tool so that you can more easily find what's available.
Well, that's just really helpful right there. I know exactly what I'm going to do with that when I leave here to help someone. All right, so, should know that. So say again how to access that at the Public Service Commission.
Yeah, I think the easiest route would be to go to, of course, I'm familiar with our website, but danenet.org, our digital equity project. On there's a listing of our three main branches, and I think the one that's in the center is the affordable internet. And so there's a link right there that tells you more about how to look that up on the Public Service Commission. And some links directly to some of those affordable internet options, so you can see what's available at your home address.
So the kind of need for DaneNet's work, whether it's the support, technical support to nonprofits, which I think is the need for affordable technical support, as well as the digital equity. Can you talk about that need? I mean, this kind of digital equity without it closes a lot of opportunities for people, right? Because everything's online. I mean, they want to put a lot of government services online for efficiency, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I just think about trying to, when you wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is reach for my cell phone, right? And so to think about moving through my day, finding the bus schedule, communicating with, you know, your kids' school and teachers, accessing those resources that you were just describing, trying to find housing, jobs, all of that stuff, whether you don't have access to the internet because you don't have that device or you don't have the confidence and skills to be able to comfortably navigate to those resources, it just closes a lot of doors that don't need to be closed.
The way that you raised funding for some of the ways that you raise money for the to promote digital equity is at these e-cycling events that are going to be happening this year. And there's one coming up in April. I wanted to talk with you today so people could prepare, because you got to get organized and get your stuff ready if you are able to donate. So can you tell folks about the project? I know people are going to ask and be thinking about security.
Absolutely. Yes. Do a little spring cleaning, gather up that tech that you're no longer using. And it could be tech that you just have upgraded since you bought that one. Or maybe it's stuff that's just no longer working. You can bring all of that to our tech e-cycling event. It's going to be Tuesday, April 22nd, which is Earth Day, from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. And it's going to be at Alliant Energy Center. When you drive down John Nolan, you should see the big trucks in that parking lot that's along John Nolan. But you're going to enter off of Rimrock. The idea is that we are going to be able to collect all kinds of residential technology. So we're talking about computers, laptops, monitors, TVs, computer devices like mice or an external hard drive or a keyboard, smartwatches, tablets, cell phones, all of that stuff. You can bring all of that. We are partnered with an organization, a local business called Cascade Asset Management, and they are going to be handling all the technology. They are licensed up. They are very secure. They hold themselves to extremely high standards. And so their job is to collect that technology, securely wipe it of all your personal data, and then kind of decide what path it follows from there. If it's something we can use directly in our refurbished laptop program, they're going to give that device back to us so we can hand it out through our nonprofit partners to folks that need it. If it's something that isn't a fit for that, like maybe it's last generation smartwatch or something, they have a marketplace where they sell secondhand items, and so they turn those donations we can't use into dollars we can use, and then donate that back to the Digital Equity Project. So then we'll be able to send our educator out to do one more digital skills class at the local library. And then the third option would be if that device just is not functioning anymore, Cascade has the expertise to safely kind of break that tech down into its components, gather up any raw materials that can be reused, and safely dispose or recycle of all of the components of it.
So then all of this is returned back into the digital equity program. So it's an important fundraiser.
Exactly. So we're either getting the technology that we can use right away, or they're turning it into dollars donations that we can use to fund whatever part of the program we're seeing the greatest need for.
And then part of the data security scrub means scrub and destroy, right?
Yep. All this is, in addition to feeling good about how your technology is going to support digital equity and it's, or it's going to be really safely disposed of and it's not going to sit in a landfill and do damage for years and years, you can also feel really good because this would be the safe way to make sure that your data is not getting leaked out in the world. The folks at Cascade have to pass a lot of security measures. So your information is safe with them. If you go to their website, cascade-assets.com, they have a lot of information about kind of the rigorous processes that they go through to make sure that everything is going to be safe and secure until they wipe it. I've seen the hard drive shredders there. It's super cool.
All right. So do not bring appliances, copiers, fax machines, medical devices, or technology from businesses. The event is on Tuesday, April 22nd. We wanted to give you a couple of weeks to give you a heads up while if you have these and are cleaning. The date is Tuesday, the 22nd. The hours and where?
The hours are 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. So your morning commute, and it's at Alliant Energy Center in the parking lot that's right along John Nolan, but you want to enter from Rimrock.
And I wanted to direct you to the website because if you miss cleaning for April 22nd, I think there's another one at the end of the summer in August, right?
So it's actually August 22nd. We'll be having that one over at Warner Park.
So take a look at the website. Hey, Sarah Lynn, thank you for speaking with me. Sarah Lynn is the Director of Development at DayNet. Thank you. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hey, and thank you to Dave Lawrenson, our engineer, Ms. Tina, our receptionist and phone answerer. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I'll talk with you next week.
And it's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. Excuse me. Right here in Madison. Coming up next, Bill and Bobby are going to take us back to the country, so stay tuned for that.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, March 26th.
This is Bird Note. Here they come. Rufous hummingbirds, ruby throats, and others are migrating north after a hot, dry winter in sunny Mexico or Central America. And they're ready for a drink. Hummingbirds need to consume several times their body weight each day, so they're looking for flowering plants to quench that mighty thirst. If a whirring puffball is hovering at your window, consider becoming a hummingbird bartender. To help feed them, select a hummingbird feeder that you can easily clean on the inside, and one that has plenty of red to attract the birds. Then fill it with sugar water made by dissolving one part sugar in four parts water. No honey or sugar substitutes allowed, and please, no red food coloring. There's no need to feel guilty that feeding hummers will lure them away from their natural sources of nourishment. The birds will continue to consume a healthy balance of plant nectar, small insects, and sap. So set out a feeder, and before long, you may be hearing a hummingbird hovering around your watering hole. You can learn a lot more about hummingbirds and what attracts them. Begin at our